The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, March 2018, Volume 20, Number 3. And this is the fourth of five installments of the March issue. Oprah shares this month's cover with Mindy Kaling and Reese Witherspoon. The three of them stand out in their black and white dresses against the rose beige background. The big headline is, "Where do we go from here?" What we know for sure, things between men and women will never be the same. The big black O for Oprah magazine sits in a white rectangle in the upper left-hand corner of the cover. And let's start this fourth installment with advice from Martha Beck. And Martha has been moved to the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. There used to be a section called May We Help You, and it had four or five contributors. Martha's been moved, along with the other contributors, to Live Your Best Life. This is part three of a four-part series, and it's called Easy Does It. Dixie Late has set some ambitious goals, but she's still dogged by her lack of discipline. Fortunately, O Life coach Martha Beck knows a few motivational tricks. And we have a picture of Dixie sitting on the sofa in her New York apartment, along with her puppy dog, Dr. Waffles. When freelance writer and brand consultant Dixie Late needed to climb out of the doldrums and find her destiny, she asked O Life coach Martha Beck to be her guide. Martha began by advising her new client to get in touch with her gut, literally, by breathing deeply and focusing on physical sensations. She said, quote, "If you pay attention to your body, you will feel physically pulled toward what's right for you." Dixie confessed her passion for glossy magazines and street fashion blogs that feature, quote, "women of a certain age who dress the way I do," end of quote. As her way of feeling joyful and relaxed. Martha thought, aha, following small pleasures is the way to find your grand purpose. Who proceeded to give the 55-year-old New Yorker a homework assignment? Do only what delights you. Has Dixie been following her bliss? Let's find out. And here's a dialogue between Martha and Dixie. Martha, so tell me what's been going on in your life since we talked. Dixie, okay, I've taken some concrete steps. I got someone to help me develop a website and blog. I want to call it Dame Town and write about old-fashioned dame heroes from the movies or real life and also my own experiences. Martha, that's huge. Dixie, but here's where my discipline problem comes in. I'll say, I'm going to learn French. Then instead of signing up for a class, all I do is buy a bunch of t-shirts with French words on them. Martha, you're stuck in a common pattern, and the cure is so hard for people to grasp. I call it having the courage to do the small. This means taking tiny, incremental turtle steps. Dixie, let's talk about that. I already put the cover of O on my bathroom mirror to remind me to work on the blog for just like an hour a day. Martha, oh, honey, an hour? Dixie, that may be too long. Martha, how much have you been doing? Dixie, zero. Martha, here's the reason. Your steps are too big. You're an animal, and your motivational system works the way an animal's system works. But you're trying to apply an analytical approach. You put out a lofty goal and think you'll just keep striving, and the only motivation you need is this vague idea that one day you'll be fantastic. But to train an animal, you give high levels of reinforcement for very small moves. To train a killer whale to jump out of the water, you start by rewarding it just for coming to the surface. If it won't come all the way to the surface, you reward it for advancing 4 or 5 feet. Dixie. When I tell myself I have to write for only 20 minutes, I usually get going and find it impossible to stop. But I have this platonic ideal of what the blog should be, and now that it's time to really work on it, I worry it's just going to be lame. Martha. I'm speaking to you from experience. Every time you sit down and actually write a paragraph, it's a piece of crap compared to your fantasy. That's why it takes courage to do small things. Human beings would rather commit to 12 huge things and then never follow through. Dixie, I always seem to pick the path of least resistance. Martha, I don't think it's about choosing the path of least resistance. What you're reacting to is not effort, it's fear. It's fear of the self-loathing you'll feel when you look at something small that you've done and tell yourself how pathetic it is. Dixie, there's no real reason to assume I'll fail. I've never really failed at anything I've tried. Martha, not in the outside world, but inside your mind, you're continuously generating stories about yourself, and these narratives are stronger than anything we might call objective reality. People look for evidence to support what they already believe, and they can construct it out of gossamer. Once, I led a seminar where people were working with horses, and I said to one woman, "Were you an athlete in college? You're so graceful." She sulked all day and finally burst out with, "I was doing fine until you started screaming that I should be more athletic. I knew you would say something cruel." Dixie, I'm afraid I'm inadequate, and it's scary to put myself in a situation where I might be proved right. Martha, we create our mental afflictions by creating these narratives. Comparing ourselves with others or comparing our performance with what we think it should be. The Buddhists believe a comparing mind is one of the greatest sources of suffering. An animal doesn't do this. When a beaver builds a dam, he doesn't think about whether it's as great as the other dams. He just keeps building. Dixie, you must have hit a nerve because I feel like I'm about to cry. Martha, sweetie, the essential self often weeps when it finds itself understood. I could sit here all day and tell you how amazing I think you are, and I do, by the way, but it won't defeat your own thought patterns. What will help is starting to think of yourself as part brain, but mostly animal. When you attack yourself for not being good enough, you're giving electric shocks to an animal. We've talked about showing yourself the same compassion you'd offer your pets. When you think about them suffering, what happens to your body? Dixie, well, I didn't do that part of the homework, sitting quietly and feeling my physical sensations. I'd rather do 50 push-ups. Martha, listening to your body is still the most powerful thing you can do to change your life. But if you're not doing it, that means it's too big of a step. Before our next session, I have 2 objectives for you. First, I want you to start noticing how you feel physically when you do something rewarding, even if it's just petting your dog. The second thing is to find a tiny turtle step that you can take every day. You said writing for 20 minutes builds your momentum? Try 10 minutes. What you write can be stupid and horrible. In fact, put at the top of the page, "This is stupid and horrible," but do it. When is your energy highest? Dixie, mornings. Martha, so sit down first thing in the morning. By day 4, you'll be tempted to skip it, but keep going. Because in my experience, that's the point when the brain starts thinking, "Oh, that's what I do at this time every day." Set a timer for 10 minutes, and when it goes off, stop and give yourself a little reward. I like a cup of rooibos tea. Dixie, maybe I shouldn't have my coffee until after 10 minutes are up. Martha, don't rob the animal of anything. We're not taking anything away. We are adding a reward. If you do this, something weird will happen. You'll find yourself whining and pleading to do more. Dixie, what if I want to keep going past the 10-minute mark? Martha, don't. You have to stop after 10 minutes because the animal won't trust you if you lie to it. If it works bravely and proudly for 10 minutes as you asked it to, and then you don't give it a rest and reward, it will feel betrayed and stop working for you. If you get excited and want to keep riding, you can come back to it later in the day. But right now, you want to motivate your animal self by routine and reward until you become enchanted by the activity. Dixie, okay, I'll try. You're very kind. If you're ever in New York, Martha, let me shower you with jewels. Martha laughs. I live in the woods in my pajamas. In all seriousness, if you do the 10-minute thing, that would be the greatest reward you could offer me. Next month, in their final meeting, Martha and Dixie talk about truth, beauty, and living happily ever after. Sitting on a tabletop in Dixie's apartment is a picture of the actress Claudette Colbert, who is one of Dixie's favorite dames. Ms. Colbert sent this photo in response to fan mail from 11-year-old Dixie, and it is autographed. Let's move on now to another article in the Live Your Best Life section, and this one is under the subtitle Connections, and it's called Father Knew Best. Battling a puzzling, precipitous illness, Jane Ratcliffe reached out and grabbed a lifeline. Shortly after I was born, Jane writes, my mother was hospitalized and received daily doses of shock treatment. She had what we now know to be diagnosed as postpartum depression. But in the early 60s, much of female psychological distress was called hysteria. My father is a kind and intelligent man, so the doctors must have presented a convincing case to get him to agree to have my mother's brain lightning bolted with electricity. Because agree he did. And from this improper care, a family legend was born. My mother was crazy. I not only bought into this myth, but also harbored a fear that I was destined to become crazy, too. So part of me wasn't surprised when in January 2008, the prophecy began to bear fruit. It was after midnight when I called my father. My heart had been racing for several days. I was tired, yet my nervous system was locked into go, go, go. My skin had turned yellow. The whites of my eyes appeared gray, and my normally pink nail beds were colorless. Though not usually one to shed tears, I couldn't stop crying. The room was flipping over. My short-term memory had all but disappeared. When I took my daily walk, I was unable to find my way home even from a block away. Also, the pain was back. Since the late 90s, when a tabletop in a furniture showroom fell on my head, I'd experienced bouts of debilitating physical agony. Now it felt like my head was locked in an ever-tightening vise. My 80-year-old father was not unaccustomed to my calling and asking him to bail me out. In high school, I'd sneaked out many times to clubs and parties, from which he often had to collect me. At 20, when I dropped out of college and moved to New York City without a job or a contact, he was my financial and emotional support system. So though it had been a while, he knew to take a midnight phone call for me in stride. But on this night, something in my voice concerned him enough that he lurched out of bed, leaving my 79-year-old mother, who'd been healthy and self-sufficient for decades, and drove an hour to my house in his pajamas. He ended up staying 3 months. It's connected to my head injury, I'd say, as red-hot adrenaline shot up my arms. He would say in his charcoal London baritone, "Yes, and we're going to fix it." I wasn't sure either of us was right. I'd never told anyone about my mother's hospitalization, in part out of respect for her privacy, and in part because I feared they would start to see me as I saw myself, teetering on the brink. I'd gone to therapy diligently for years, working to stay sane. Now I worried it had all been for naught. Every day, every hour, I would ask my father, "Am I going crazy?" By which I meant, am I fulfilling my role in our lineage? Each time he would reply, "Absolutely not." By which he meant, I won't let that happen again. After he arrived, every week involved a visit to some sort of doctor. I told each one about the head injury. I explained that I'd lived through crushing headaches before, and though I'd never experienced symptoms this severe or wide-ranging, I knew the old injury was to blame. Doctor after doctor dismissed my self-diagnosis with a hastily scrawled prescription for a psychotropic drug. A few suggested I try not to think so much. But my father stood by me. Every morning he made me oatmeal. Lunch was always a cheddar and avocado sandwich, lovingly cut into fours. On Sundays, he'd drive to his house to pick up enough of my mother's home-cooked dinners to get us through the week. When the adrenaline rushes were particularly bad, he ran with me around the kitchen table and up and down the stairs until the surges dissipated. At night, he sat in the rocking chair beside my bed and read to me from Winnie the Pooh. More complicated plot lines confused me. On gray, slushy afternoons, my father would tell literal war stories. How, as a child, he'd been evacuated from London and separated from his family. And for the first time, he told me that when he and my mother arrived in America in 1954, the job he'd been promised didn't exist. So he'd trudged up and down the streets of Detroit in a woolen English suit during a muggy August, making inquiries at auto engineering firms. He told me, I was disconsolate. We all seem to suffer, he seemed to be saying. You haven't been singled out. He also encouraged me to think positively and have patience. Thanks to his profession, he had a cache of car analogies about bringing the vehicle into balance. He repeated them so often that I could soon speak with some authority about carburetors, pistons, and cracked aprons. Above my kitchen sink, he posted three dots and a dash, Morse code for the letter V, echoing Winston Churchill's World War II era V for victory sign. His daughter, too, would rise again. On my worst nights, I rushed to my father in tears, wondering whether I should at last go to the emergency room. He'd gaze thoughtfully at me and say no. Then he would tell me a story. The evenness of his voice, coupled with his very presence, helped me feel as good as I was able to. But the next day, the cycle would begin again. It's the head injury, I'd say. Yes, he'd say. Am I going crazy? I'd say. No, he'd say. I didn't want to let him down. At times, I would imagine my mother in a hospital robe being led by a stern-faced nurse down a narrow green hall to a room where she would be instructed to lie on a bed, her heart racing. There they'd strap down her wrists and ankles, preparing her head for the electrodes. Then the image would change. It was me being led down the hall. One day, my father took me to see yet another physician. We drove an hour to Dr. Denton's office in my dad's Crown Victoria. Along the side of the road, daffodils were in bloom. The doctor, a small, straight-backed man, a few words, actually believed me. In his office, my father and I finally saw an X-ray of my head and neck. It turned out my original injury hadn't healed properly, and my head was on crooked, reducing the oxygen supply to my brain. Worst case I've seen in 28 years, Dr. Denton said, indicating the precarious angle at which my skull was perched on my spine. How had I not noticed this in the mirror? How had friends and family missed it? Why hadn't the previous doctors known the symptoms of anxiety are uncannily similar to those of insufficient oxygen to the brain? You must have a strong will, Dr. Denton told me. Otherwise, I don't know how you've been functioning. I glanced at my father, who gave me a nod of camaraderie. I wasn't crazy after all. As my body slowly healed with the help of Dr. Denton, chiropractors, and craniosacral therapy, no surgery or braces yet, I often wondered why my dad had been so keen to keep me away from the emergency room. Did he worry that if the ER workers trained to view the world as, well, an emergency, had seen me in that state, there was a good chance I'd have been whisked away like my mother? On the ride home from Dr. Denton's office, I gazed out the window at the passing flowers, so bright on that rare day of Michigan sun. Thank you, I said, turning to my dad, by which I meant for believing me. He looked surprised. You're welcome, he said, by which he meant I knew better this time. We're all marked by stories, bad decisions, missed opportunities, mistakes made in distress. But sometimes, with luck and love, our histories can be transformed into the medicine that makes us whole. Let's look now at the O list, a few blue and white things we think are just great. And this first page, we have two paper cups. Well, they look like paper cups, coffee splashing out of both of them. And they have the little rolled top, just like, you know, a Starbucks cup. And the title is Breakfast at Tiffany's. Why gulp your morning coffee from a paper cup when you can sip from bone china made to look like a paper cup? This is a high glam irony from one of the most iconic stores on earth. Now, of course, they are Tiffany blue on the outside, white on the inside, and the lettering Tiffany and Company is kind of small and discreet and very elegant looking on each of these. Tiffany and Co. Everyday Objects Bone China Paper Cups, $95 per pair at Tiffany.com. And when we turn the page, we have four dinner plates. And they're blue and white patterns, four different blue and white patterns. A couple of them are the toile, you know, the little pastoral scenes with the trees and the little, you know, brick tower in the background and 18th century farm scenes on them. And one of them is that classic toile look with vines and flowers and birds. And the other two are just a denser blue floral pattern. They have a little sort of ruffled edge. They look a bit like that paper plate edge. The China syndrome. Question, what could be better for a garden party than classic blue and white plates? A, answer, knowing they're nearly unbreakable, BPA-free melamine. Bright and blue garden plates, originally $24 for a set of four, now 20% off with code Oprah. Glitterville.com. Above the title Feminine Protection, we have a natural fedora with a sort of Williamsburg blue and navy blue ribbon around the hat. Whether you're looking for a pretty way to block the sun or just paying homage to Bruno Mars, this straw fedora wins the blue ribbon for providing equal parts shade and uptown funk. Freddie Fedora, originally $78, now 20% off with code Oprah at DraperJames.com. Now, here's a snazzy band for your Apple Watch. I'm with the band, says the Heading, The Great Gatsby meets Judy Jetson when you update your Apple Watch with this vintage-inspired woven nylon strap. And it is kind of powder blue and navy blue. Apple Watch Series 3 GPS plus cellular, $399, and woven nylon band, $49 at apple.com. Here's some cookware. This 12-piece collection has a non-stick textured interior, riveted steel handles, a terrific price, and a lifetime warranty. Personal chef not included. They are a metallic sort of royal blue on the outside of the pots, and the lids are a brushed stainless look. Aisha Curry, Home Collection Porcelain Enamel Cookware Set, $140 at jcpenney.com. And now, here's something pretty funky. This is called a portable table lamp. It's an elongated oval that is hollow in the middle. It doesn't look like a lamp at all. Maybe artwork. It's white on the outside. It looks to be maybe a half inch thick with a royal blue lining on the inside. And the whole thing is maybe 5 or 6 inches deep. Under the heading, Wait Until Dark, here's the best lantern since the ones that let Paul Revere know the British were coming. It's got built-in batteries and a charging port, LED lights for dimming, and enough power to illuminate your life. Concept Mr. Go Portable Table Lamp, originally $250, now 20% off with code Oprah at lumens.com. Next up is a cake stand with kind of an oversized blue gingham print design on it. Let them eat cake. Here's a no-fail party plan. Step one, go to a bakery and purchase a cake. Step two, serve it on this charmingly old-fashioned plate. Step three, gracefully accept accolades. At home with Mariki Cake Plate, originally $64, now 20% off with code Oprah. Go to thefrenchfarm.com. Dress for recess is the next item. You don't know what to wear, but you know you don't want anything fussy, faddish, or tight. Tory Burch's wardrobe staple is slimming, terry towel soft, and perfect for jeans or a pencil skirt. It's a fashion no-brainer. So what is it? It's a white tunic with navy blue stripes around the bottom, the sleeves, and the neckline. The Tory tunic, $278, torybirch.com. Pitcher Perfect is our next item. White earthenware pitchers are glazed to a high shine with a sky blue interior. They're sculptural, contemporary, and easy to love. So they are very slender and very plain with a very stylized spout. And the handle goes from the very top to the very bottom in this elegant sort of narrow kind of Danish modern look. Roost Baez pitchers from $63 each at artisancraftedhome.com. And then a next item here. What's blue and white and chic all over? These witty, pretty, ultra-modern yet traditional porcelain vases, striped on one side, floral on the other, manage to look special with or without flowers. So this is a modern take on chinoiserie. The taller of the two vases, they are, each of them is flat, with about a 2-inch side. The taller one has the outline of a ginger jar. We're seeing the back of it, which is looks as if it's been hand-painted with a brush in blue and white stripes with a floral design on the side. And the other smaller vase we see is, again, the ginger jar shape. This one doesn't have the lid shape attached to it. And it has a lovely blue, large floral pattern. Twig, New York, well-versed, 7.8-inch vase, originally $83, and 11-inch vase, originally $130. Now 20% off with code Oprah at ImprovisoLab.com. Let's move now to the reading room and look at 10 titles to pick up now. The first one is Feel Free by Zadie Smith. It seems that nothing is beyond the purview of Smith, who, between acclaimed novels, publishes must-read essays on Brexit, her mother's fascination with toilets, Justin Bieber, Jordan Peele's Get Out, and 27 other subjects, curated in this provocative collection. The second title is Blue Dreams by Lauren Slater. In this gonzo examination of the messy history and brave future of psychotropic drugs, writer and psychologist Slater sifts through the remedies one in five Americans relies on but knows little about, even breaking into an abandoned asylum in her quest. The third title, The Line Becomes a River by Francisco Cantu. An essayist, translator, and former Border Patrol agent raised in West Texas, Cantu has studied the boundary separating the U.S. and Mexico from both sides. His beautifully written account of a life between nations cuts through the politics surrounding the wall to probe what's really at stake. The fourth title, Dreadful Young Ladies by Kelly Barnhill. In the opening story, a beloved widow is described as having a voice that's, quote, all brisk assurance that required a yes, end of quote. The same could be said of this playful, witchy collection of addictive tales. The fifth title is A False Report by T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong. In 2008, a teenager alleged she was raped, then recanted when her community cast doubt on her version of events. And that's just one of the twists and turns in this riveting true crime story. The sixth title is This Will Be My Undoing by Morgan Jerkins. Combining memoir and criticism, Jerkins' potent mental fermentation broods on black female oppression and the limits of racial equality in a society dominated by white people who have, quote, fooled themselves into believing that they are, quote, unraced, end of quote. The seventh title is The House of Impossible Beauties by Joseph Cassera. Inspired by the real-life drag queens of the House of Extravaganza, mainstreamed by the documentary Paris is Burning, Cassera's vivacious debut novel explores the power of a chosen family. The eighth title is Black Ink, edited by Stephanie Stokes Oliver. Imagine an intimate, fiery conversation between Frederick Douglass, Roxane Gay, and Barack Obama, in which reading is extolled as among, quote, the first miracles along the path to black authorship, end of quote. A breathtaking anthology celebrating the power of the written word to forge change. The ninth title is The Undertaker's Daughter by Sarah Bladel. The Danish crime novelist takes a trip stateside in this exhilaratingly morbid tale of a 40-year-old Copenhagen widow who travels to Wisconsin to run her dead father's funeral home and is forced to confront the enemies he left behind. And finally, our tenth title, Educated by Tara Westover. As a girl in the remote Idaho mountains, the young Westover didn't attend school, see doctors, or interact with the outside world. That all changed when she left home and her religion to attend Harvard, a coming-of-age memoir reminiscent of The Glass Castle. And now we have something special in the reading room this month, Oprah's Book Club 2018 selection. And we have a picture of Oprah with the author, Tyari Jones. Oprah is in a gray V-necked sweater and a white stand-up collar shirt with her hair pulled back, and she has these very bookish-looking black glasses on. And the author is in this magenta pink scoop-necked cap-sleeve little shift dress, and her cute little afro hairdo is very short and close to her head. And both of them are, of course, smiling, and Oprah's got her arm around Miss Tayari. Tayari Jones's An American Marriage is an aha moment inducing tour de force, a love story, and a stinging indictment of society's injustices. It's also Oprah's new book club pick. Oprah says, whenever I open a book, I'm embarking on an adventure. Where will it take me? Who will I meet along the way? What will I learn about the world and my place in it? And best of all, will I love it so much, I want to choose it for my book club. In the case of Tayari Jones's fourth novel, An American Marriage, the answer to that last question was an emphatic yes. And the first few chapters... After the first few chapters, as I got to know Roy and Celestial and Andre, I forgot they were fictional characters. I found myself in that zone readers yearn for. I wanted to cancel all my plans and curl up with my new friends. I won't spoil the experience by giving away too much of the plot. Suffice it to say that a wrongful arrest and conviction shatter the lives of the couple at its center, exposing the cracks in the foundation of their relationship and creating new ones where none existed before. The tale unfolds through alternating narrators, each voice as intimate as a confidant. You're inside the heads and hearts of all three, feeling the unfairness, the righteous anger, the helplessness, the confusion, and also the complexity and joy of love. When I finished, I immediately began sharing the book with others, and they too devoured it, periodically checking in to talk about what might happen next. By the end, we were discussing the goings-on between Roy, Celestial, and Andre, as if gossiping about next-door neighbors. It's among Tayari's many gifts that she can touch us soul to soul with her words, and that those words are so glorious. A few months ago, I phoned Tayari to tell her I'd decided to make An American Marriage my new Oprah's book club selection. She wasn't expecting me, and at first she just laughed and kept saying, "Oh my goodness." Then we got talking, and here's that conversation. Oprah, how did you come up with the idea of this epic love triangle that also wrestles with the hardcore issue of mass incarceration? It's definitely not a natural pairing, Miss Jones. My earlier novels were all about me trying to sort out the complications of my own family. With Silver Sparrow, I felt like I put that baby to bed. And with all the chaos in the world, I wanted to look outward and take on something that mattered to others, not just me. Oprah, how did you land on criminal justice? Tayari. To Black Americans, mass incarceration is an ongoing threat, like hurricanes on the coast and earthquakes or fires in California. Prison can swoop in and snatch up the men in our families at any time. I decided to write about the collateral damage around that, what happens to families, to relationships, to dreams for the future. How does this social wrong translate into the everyday? As a novelist, it was that messy gray area I wanted to explore. Oprah, define what you mean by gray area. Tayari, my character, Roy, is an innocent man being punished for a crime he didn't commit, which disrupts not only his life, but those of his wife and parents. No ambiguity there. I'd spent nearly a year researching the subject of incarceration at Harvard and accumulated lots of facts, but couldn't find a way into the more nuanced story I was trying to create. Then one day I was at the mall and overheard an argument between a couple. She carried herself elegantly. She didn't seem like the kind of person who hashes things out with her man in a food court. She shouted at him, "You know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." I had no idea why they'd been separated or whether jail time was involved, but a light bulb went off. Suddenly I had my story. Oprah. I love the title, An American Marriage. How did you come up with it? Tayari. At first, I was calling the book Dear History, but that sounded so academic. I shifted to This Is How I Love You, which spoke to the romance angle but trivialized the broader theme. I was brainstorming alternatives, and an American marriage popped into my head. But I was nervous it was too big a title for my book, that it suggested a novel, say, about white people in Connecticut getting a divorce. For most of my life, American wasn't a word I felt was addressed to me without adding black. But my editor urged me to consider it, and I began to realize that in adopting it, I'd be claiming a larger space for my characters and their story. But did I dare? My mentor, Pearl Cleage, gave me this advice. You are an American author, and this is an American story. So I went with it. Oprah, wow. That's what I love about the title. It owns the scale of the story. Are there writers who have especially influenced you? Tayari, I read Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon at least once a year. When I teach it, I'm the crazy English professor reading aloud with tears streaming down my cheeks. The other consistent influence on my work is Greek mythology. In this novel, Roy is like Odysseus. He faces an incredible challenge, has to fight to get home, and meets other women along the way, yet all he wants is to know his wife is waiting for him. Alas, Celestial is no Penelope. Oprah, ha, I heard there was a point when you considered giving up writing. Tayari, there were so many times I wondered where the universe had given me all the books it was going to. I asked myself if I should forget writing and do something else. I went back to Pearl and asked if she thought I was done, and she said, "Maybe you are, and maybe you're not." Somehow that released me from the pressure of having to finish what I started and allowed the story to just be. Oprah, oh, I'm so glad you stuck with it. I so love this book, Tayari. Thank you for writing it. And Tayari responds, "Thank you, ma'am." Let's move now to the Oh Beautiful section of the magazine. Does your skin need a therapist? Hop on the couch. Psychodermatologists, part derm, part shrink, explain how your feelings show up on your skin. Blushing when you're embarrassed, breaking out in goosebumps when you hear something chilling. They're common examples that prove we just can't separate how we feel from how our skin looks. Can we use that information to our face's benefit? Yes. So say the dual-purpose docs we spoke to, dermatologists with additional training in psychiatry or psychology, or vice versa, who treat both the physical and the emotional. Along with taking care of their patients' skin, they may practice talk therapy or even prescribe antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. The upshot? A unique perspective when it comes to solving all kinds of complexion concerns. Read on for their special brand of skin-saving advice. Lesson 1. The mind-skin connection is real. There's no shortage of ways that emotions manifest themselves in physical symptoms. Think butterflies in your stomach when you're nervous, or a pounding heart when you're scared. But this effect is particularly strong when it comes to your skin. The relationship begins in the womb. Josie Howard, MD, a board-certified psychiatrist with expertise in psychodermatology, says, quote, "The skin and nervous system share a common embryonic origin, meaning the same cells form both the brain and the skin," end of quote. This creates inextricable connection, which shows up in a multitude of ways you may not even notice. More of that later. Lesson 2. Stress is the root of many skin evils. Blame cortisol. This hormone is released anytime you feel tense, triggering a fight or flight response that enables you to react quickly in life-threatening situations. While it's beneficial, if you're being chased by a bear, it's not quite so helpful in daily life. Yet these hormonal shifts accompany every kind of stressful experience. A bad day at work, grief over the death of a loved one, prolonged anger over current events. New York City board certified dermatologist and psychiatrist Amy Weschler, MD, explains, quote, cortisol is meant to be pumped out for only a few seconds or a minute. When it's chronically elevated for days or weeks on end, it has all kinds of negative effects on the skin, end of quote. Excess cortisol breaks down collagen, increases moisture loss, triggers inflammation, dilates blood vessels, slows cell turnover, and increases sebum production, she says. Translation, say hello to wrinkles, dryness, irritation, redness, dullness, and breakouts. When a skin ailment strikes, it's on display for the world to see, which is why skin issues have such an intense emotional impact, explains Howard, quote, as soon as we sense that people around us are judging our appearance, we feel stressed. It starts a vicious cycle. Lesson 3. Sleep will save you. It's called beauty sleep for a reason. While you snooze at night, cortisol levels are at their lowest and growth hormones are at their highest, explains Weschler. These nutritive molecules ensure your outer layer is functioning properly and maximizing its ability to repair itself, she adds. Feeling serene or upbeat has similar effects to getting a good night's sleep. This is why, when you're happy, people say you're glowing. Your skin can also benefit from another bedroom activity that begins with S. Weschler says, quote, sex not only lowers cortisol, it also increases both beta endorphins and oxytocin, an anti-inflammatory molecule, end of quote, all of which work wonders for your skin. Lesson 4, don't treat one without the other. Because the skin and the mind are so intertwined, psychodermatologists often recommend a two-pronged treatment approach. When it comes to products, the right formulations can be hugely beneficial. Weschler points out, quote, there are a lot of things working against us, but a good skincare regimen is one thing we can control, end of quote. The items here, and I'll read those in just a minute, can help promote overall skin health and anti-aging. But if you're dealing with a chronic condition such as acne or eczema, both of which are exacerbated by stress, it might be time to incorporate anti-stress practices into your beauty routine. That means quick daily meditation sessions, regular exercise, a cup of tea, whatever helps you chill out. Weschler advises, quote, what makes someone feel relaxed is completely individual. Find what's best for you, end of quote. And just knowing that you and your doctor have come up with a plan offers its own kind of relief. Howard says, quote, the treatment helps the skin, but the sense of control is in and of itself very healing and decreases cortisol levels, end of quote. Both your mind and your skin will thank you. Here are 4 products for stressed skin. To combat the effects of stress on your skin, use a twice daily antioxidant serum paired with SPF in the morning and a retinoid at night. For extra dry or irritated skin, try a barrier repair cream too. So first off the bat, we have ELF, Beauty Shield Vitamin C Pollution Prevention Serum. It's $16 at Target. Vitamins C and E help shield skin against environmental aggressors. The next item, Supergoop Unseen Sunscreen SPF 40, $32 at Sephora.com. With a light texture that won't leave a whitish cast, this lotion is one you'll want to smear on. The third one is Alginist Elevate Advanced Retinol Serum, $98 at alginist.com. Its active ingredient fights fine lines and improves skin tone and texture. And the final item, L'Oreal Paris Revitalift Cica Cream, $18 at drugstores. Gotu Kola extract helps reinforce the skin barrier for protection against irritants. Let's take a look now at some fashion advice, some recommendations in this Big Spring Lookbook. And we've been looking at these in each of the installments, so we'll look at a page or two right now. The top part of the page we're looking right now is titled Go Like the Wind, and it's full of windbreakers. Think of the windbreaker as the denim jacket's cooler, lightweight cousin. Wear it with jeans, a full skirt, or a dress. The possibilities just might surprise you. So they show a model here with a shiny red blousy windbreaker that hits at the top of the hip with a drawstring, and it has elastic at the wrist so that it has a little bit of a ruffle below that elastic, and then it has another bit of elastic above the elbow. So they've pulled it up into a very sort of puffy sleeve. And that jacket is from GILI, and it's $68 at QVC.com. So we've got this shiny red, almost fire engine red, windbreaker that's worn over an ankle-length knife-pleated white sheer skirt, and it's got this color blocking, a big sort of asymmetrical patch of black lace from the waistline to above the knee, and then there are a couple of other little lace inserts. So this is a knife pleat white maxi skirt with lace patches, and it is $695 from Derek Lamb at 10 Crosby, New York. There's also a t-shirt from American Eagle Outfitters, but it's covered by the jacket, so you can't quite see it. It looks like it has some writing on the front, and that's $25. And then there are some sneakers from Golden Goose Deluxe brand. Now let's look at the four windbreakers that they're showing us here. There are two white ones, a coral-colored one, and then that blue and white, that sort of English earthenware, indigo, blue, and white floral pattern. So the first one is this blue and white oversized floral. It's a little bit longer than some of the others. It kind of hits the top of the thigh, and it has a drawstring at the waist, and it has drawstrings at the wrists, and it has a hood. It's $179 at anntaylor.com. So it has these huge blue cabbage roses and leaves that are also blue on this white background. The next one is white. This is from Adidas Outdoor, and it's $69 at adidas.com. It has a 2-inch stand-up collar. It hits about the mid-hip. It has a drawstring waist with a lime green cord and a lime green oversized zipper. Now we have another white windbreaker from Livy, L-I-V-I, Active, $90 at lanebryant.com. Now, this one's much shorter. It hits at about the waistline. It has patch pockets on the front with flaps and little metal clasps. And the zipper is covered by a flap, and it has a very small fold-down collar. And finally, for $409 from apresboutique.com, we have a coral hooded, sleek-sleeved This one's very tailored looking. It has some inset pockets on the front and very tidy little gathers at the ankles, at the wrists, at the end of the sleeves. Very sort of silk coral looking. Okay, so there are windbreakers. And then over here on the side, it says, crazy for it. Our cover girl, Reese Witherspoon, moonlights as purveyor of her own lifestyle brand, Draper James, which offers pretty pieces like this heart print dress. Well, at first look, this little short sleeve shirt waist dress is navy blue and white polka dots. But when you look closely, what should be the white polka dots are little white hearts. And then there's a red and white band around the waist. On the bottom of this page, under pastel combos, our model is wearing a lavender double-breasted jacket and lavender wide-leg crop pants with about a 2-inch cuff on the bottom of the pants. And underneath is a black or maybe indigo tie-dyed shirt. So the jacket is from Lauren Ralph Lauren, and it's $245. The top is $198 from autumncashmere.com. It's actually like a sweater, a sleeveless sweater, little horizontal white stripes in the dark background that look like it's tie-dyed. The pants are from Lauren Ralph Lauren. They're $145. And they have these big, chunky platform sandals. The platform has the raffia rope around them, and the crisscross leather over the top of the foot is that mid-tan, and those are from Michael Kors. As we close out this fourth installment, let's listen to an answer or two from this month's question. Who inspires you to be a force for good? Susie Villa of El Paso, Texas writes, karma. It's a great reminder for my students to, quote, remember what goes around comes around, do good, end of quote. Barb Fryman of Ohio says, my friend Rena, she's the only person I know who accepts everyone just as they are. Barbara London of West Bend, Wisconsin says, my family, my husband and I believe it's important to show our teenage boys what doing the right thing looks like. Marilyn Nato of Florida writes, Barack Obama, he continues to inspire me every day, just as he did when he was president. Rochelle Moore of Cleveland says, the woman in my mirror. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.